special discussion of the role of violence in anti-capitalist struggle. My name is Michael Trussello. I'm a professor at Mount Royal University in Calgary, Alberta. I have with me Chris Hedges and Derek Jensen. Chris Hedges is the author of several books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
And Derek Jensen is also an author of several books, including Endgame and The Culture of Make-Believe. His most recent book is a collection of interviews through PM Press called Resistance Against Empire. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you.
The genesis for this discussion was a public meeting with Chris Hedges in Waterloo, Ontario, and I had a chance to talk to him, and he mentioned that he had a number of agreements with you, Derek, on your analyses of contemporary America, and one of the places in which you two disagreed somewhat was over the role of violence. So I wonder if we might start this discussion just by sort of briefly outlining where you think, where the two of you think you have a kind of general agreement about the current state of America.
Well, let me begin only because I'm sort of in debt to Derek, probably a little more than he's in debt to me. And I think that Derek has confronted a very harsh reality that large numbers of people have just, I think, because of have an emotional incapacity to confront. And that is the kind of death spiral that we are on. The collapse of the ecosystem, the collapse of globalization, which are going to have very, very soon terrifying consequences, not just ecological and economic consequences, but of course political consequences. It's very clear now that, as I think Derek has pointed out, that the engines of corporatism cannot be halted. They are impervious to the will of those who they exploit. They are more powerful than the governments they control. And they have built within them an inevitable kind of mechanism for self-annihilation, because corporations have this strange pathology where they turn everything into a commodity. Human beings become commodities, the natural world becomes a commodity, and you exploit these commodities until exhaustion or collapse. And that's precisely what's happening. So that when Derek criticizes Bill McKibben, who's a friend of mine, and Bill's very well-meaning and I like him very much, for sort of failing to confront the underlying corporate structure and the dark sort of in Freudian terms, that Thanatos element, that death drive within that structure. He's right. We can compost, we can protest, on worldwide 350.org day, we can hang our laundry in the backyard. It won't make any difference. Derek is right about that. I think he's one of the very few writers that's willing to, has the kind of courage to stand up and confront the reality that we face.
Well, thank you, Chris. And I would like to actually start off with a little bit of a disagreement with you, because I the disagreement is that I think that I'm going to claim that your work has influenced me very much as well. And your articulation that you just made is both beautiful and horrifying and accurate, unfortunately. And I agree with every word you said. And also, I want to say one more thing too, very, very quickly about Bill McKibben, which is that, I want to underscore that how, grateful I am to McKibben for the work he does in raising awareness about global warming. And I think that that's extraordinarily important. A question, if I were his friend and I could have this, I don't actually know him, but if I were his friend and I could have this conversation in a non-confrontational way with him, a question I would love to just ask him would be, so at what point would he countenance direct attacks on infrastructure? For example, 410 parts per million, 430, 450, 470, 490. You know, at what point would that be acceptable to him? And I think that's a question that at least runs through my work pretty constantly is what is our threshold to recognize the death spiral? Or what is our threshold to recognize that we don't live in a functioning democracy? What is our threshold to, in many ways also, you know, what is our threshold to simply get off our behinds and do something? In my kitchen here, I have a bunch of, you know, I'm sometimes pegged as the violence guy, and I don't really like that because I believe that we need everything. And I know we'll get to violence in a moment, I'm presuming. But in my kitchen, I have a couple of plastic tubs filled with water that have tadpoles in them. And the reason that I have that is because the local frogs, their frog egg sacs are getting eaten by a mold called Saprolegnia. And that's happening because of depletion of the ozone layer. So my response has been to simply go out and get frog egg sacs and to raise them in my kitchen because the UVB doesn't penetrate in the house and then release them. I recognize that doesn't take, you know, it doesn't take down capitalism. It doesn't address the oil economy, but what these frogs need to do is survive. And my point having to do with thresholds is it actually took me several years to realize the frogs were disappearing. And what was my threshold? You know, the threshold wasn't when they went from deafening to kind of loud. And it wasn't when they went from kind of loud to fairly quiet. It was actually when they went from fairly quiet to, oh my God, the frogs are dying. You see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah. Well, I think that you touch upon the key failing on the part of most people who have, as Bill does, a kind of consciousness about what's happening and certainly has done heroic and great work to try and raise consciousness about it. And that is that they operate from the assumption that we do live in a functioning democracy. And as you pointed out, we do not. I think the system is probably best described in the words of the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, probably our greatest living political philosopher, taught at Berkeley and later at Princeton, as a form of inverted totalitarianism. And this is a kind of very pernicious usurpation of power, because the iconography and language of American patriotism and American nationalism remains the same. Corporate or inverted totalitarianism is not like classical totalitarianism in that it revolves around a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. So that it doesn't present a radical agenda or reactionary agenda or ideology that seeks to overthrow a system, but purports to pay fealty to the system that it has so corrupted. We still have elections. We still have the facade of electoral politics, but the corporate entities have an iron control on the levers of power. And I think the Obama administration is a perfect example of that. So if you accept that this, as I do, and I think you do, that this is, in fact, the political system that we live under, that what we have undergone is a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion, then, of course, appealing to power centers is useless. And I think most people who deal in these issues have not yet confronted that very sobering fact. And therefore, and I think that because they cling to this kind of illusion of, if not a functioning democracy, at least an anemic democracy, therefore they're ineffectual because they're not actually confronting the actual centers of power.
And they're not confronting either physical or political reality.
Well, it's the culture of make-believe.
Yeah. So I want to say one thing and then I want to ask a question. And the thing I want to say is that this form of totalitarianism, one of the advantages over the sort of totalitarianism of Hitler or Stalin is that in that case, the German resistance to Hitler, at least, or German resistance to Nazism, at least had a focal point. They could attempt to assassinate Hitler, and that would have made a tangible difference. Anybody who has studied the German resistance to Hitler knows that if they take out Hitler, World War II stops. And that is a really central focus. And one of the problems we have, I think, is one of the brilliant, brilliant parts of a corporation or a bureaucracy in general is it functions to, and one of its central functions is to disperse responsibility. So it would be really, I think that the CEO of BP should go, you know, up against the wall. And then people would argue, well, then BP still exists. You know, BP is no one. And that dispersal of responsibility, I mean, for crying out loud, they're called limited liability corporations, but it couldn't be any more obvious about what the point is. And so that all, with that dispersed responsibility, with everything else, I'm going to ask a question, but then also, Michael, it's your show, so you can ignore my question, ask whatever question you want. And my question, though, is what do we do?
Well, I think that when you know, World War I created two, let's say three, deadly forms of power, which have now combined to kill us, kill the planet and kill us. The first is, of course, industrial warfare. The second is the organization of mass bureaucracies, where responsibilities are fragmented to service such a tiny part of that bureaucracy that those within the bureaucracy, because they have such narrow responsibilities, are able to morally disengage from what in fact they're doing. And the third is, of course, mass propaganda, which was perfected by the Committee for Public Information or the Creel Commission in World War I and became the model for that Goebbels. I mean, Goebbels had a copy of Edward Bernays' propaganda that this was the first successful appeal to emotion, that before World War I, the robber barons had used goons and thugs to crack the heads of strikers. After World War I, courtesy of Freud and Le Bon and others, there was an understanding that people could confuse how they were made to feel with knowledge. And so we have become a culture utterly awash in lies. We are very skillfully manipulated. This is what the Obama campaign was about. And so those three entities have essentially served to create systems, corporate systems, which, as you point out, Derek, thrive, even if, you know, the heads of these systems disappear, that they have, they are propelled forward by their own, twisted and frightening logic, which is, of course, the accumulation of profit at the expense of human life. So how do you confront these entities? Unlike fascism, which tends to revolve around a charismatic figure, and you're certainly right, after 1943, most of the plots. There were 23 plots against Hitler's life. They were carried out by officers in the Wehrmacht, one of whom I happened to have met before he died, one of the very few survivors of the von Stauffenberg plot, Axel Vandenbusch. And
oh, my God, you met him?
Yeah, spent 3 days with him in Switzerland, yeah.
Let's talk about that another time. Oh, my gosh.
And they understood that after 1943, Hitler's propagation of the war was destroying their country. So you're perfectly correct that it would have ended the war, and they would have sued for peace. But I'm not sure that is a form of totalitarianism which is so different from the totalitarianism that we're experiencing that taking out a figure, I think, will not in any way impede the system at all.
It seems, Chris, like the problems you've identified are things that it's very difficult for the common people to confront them on their own terms. So, for example, the propaganda matrix in which we live, we've had decades of quite skillful alternative media, and it doesn't seem to have made much of a difference in the functioning of the consolidation of corporate media and the consolidation of its messages as well. You could say similar things about confronting states or confronting bureaucracies. And I wonder why that is, especially given what Derek has said about one's threshold. Surely at this point, if you were at all informed, you would recognize that we're in a great deal of trouble environmentally and in other ways. So we have to presume that there are a significant number of people out there who just don't realize that.
Well, this is what Derek wrote about in The Culture of Make-Believe. It's what I wrote about in Empire of Illusion. We're arguably, and I'll let Derek respond to this, but we're arguably the most illusioned culture or society on the planet. We believe this childish mantra, which is fed to us across the political and cultural spectrum, which says that we can have anything we want, that reality is not an impediment to what we desire, that all we have to do is find our inner strength or focus on happiness or dig deep enough within ourselves or grasp that we are truly exceptional or believe that Jesus really can carry out miracles. And what this does is it keeps the mass of the population in a kind of perpetual infantilism where they never grow up. What's happening now is that the illusion of who we are, the illusion of where we are going, and the reality, that gap is widening to such an extent, so that as collapse begins to appear, and it is beginning to appear, 2.8 million Americans lost their homes last year to bank repossessions and foreclosures. That's 8,000 people a day. Over 2.4 million will this year. Half, of course, of all bankruptcies are caused by an inability to pay for medical bills. As this gap opens up and we confront personal disintegration as well as ecological and economic disintegration, we're not prepared emotionally, psychologically, or intellectually for what's happening. And so we react as children, which is to reach out for a demagogue or a savior, somebody who promises new glory, moral renewal, and vengeance. And then I think, and I'm curious to know what Derek thinks, I think we could very swiftly revert to a much more classical form of totalitarianism, although this would not in any way disrupt the engines of globalism and corporate power.
Well, I will respond to all this as soon as I am done attempting to kill myself from frustration at everything you just said, which is so accurate. This infantilism just frustrates me so much. And actually, in many ways, I think that the belief systems are even worse than that. There's the we can have it all. That's really atrocious and atrocity inducing. There's the magical thinking, you know, we can just get a sustainable culture for Christmas, you know, or there's all of this. And then in addition, part of the, I'm just right now, going through the edits on a book I have coming out. And one of the things, this is another part of my sort of attack on, scientific materialistic linear thinking. And in there, one of the statements that I take apart is Richard Dawkins' statement that science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. And my point in bringing this up is that I don't think a lot of people would consider that statement to be outrageous at all, but that statement's utterly outrageous because it means that our epistemology itself, how we know, is based on enslaving others. The science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. In other words, to enslave others. And that shows how deep the entitlement runs. And one of the problems we face is that there's a great book by Lundy Bancroft called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men. And it talks about, it's about abusers. And it's how It destroys a lot of myths about abusers, one of which is that abusers lose control, because he asks simple questions like, so does the abuser simply lose his temper and start beating up a cop? Huh, what do you know? When he destroys stuff, does he destroy his own stereo? Huh, what do you know? And it ends up that what he describes, which I really believe, is that, and I've said this in other books too, that a lot of atrocity is based on perceived entitlement. And a lot of our problem is that this culture is based on the perceived entitlement that the rest of the world exists for us. And it doesn't matter whether you're a fundamentalist Christian who believes that God gave man dominion over the earth, or whether you're a scientist who believes that, you know, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command, or whether you just believe that non-humans don't have subjective reality. And so many Indians have said to me that the primary difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And of course, how you perceive others affects how you behave toward them. If I perceive trees, as a Canadian lumberman said, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at trees, I see trees as individual subjective beings, I'll treat them differently. And this is all going to have a point. Same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, this is one of the many, many problems with pornography. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women as subjective beings, I'll treat them differently. And if you perceive others as objects to be exploited and thrown away, that's a really good definition of sociopathy. Sociopathology, psychopathology, whatever you want to call it. And and now I'm going to jump back to the entitlement. And one of the problems is that members of this culture, and yeah, the whole thing is collapsing, and we're utterly, for many reasons, have been infantilized, and we are, many of us, incapable of responding to the multiple crises we face. Excuse me. And part of the problem is that we are addicted, I believe, to this entitlement. And this is true for abusers in general. And one of the problems with addiction, a couple problems with addiction, one of them is it has a wonderful etymology. It comes from the root meaning to enslave. And it's the same root as dictate, that a judge would hand down a statement that a dictate that you are now enslaved to another. You are now addicted to another. And what happens is that the heroin no longer serves the addict, but the addict serves the heroin. And the same is true. Who was it? Who's the great sociologist who said, in the past, the man was first, in the future, the system will be first? I can't remember his name right now. But that's an absolutely crucial statement, which came about 10, 15 years before what you were talking about with World War I, that unholy combination of forces that are destroying all. Anyway, one of the problems with addiction, the cliche is, that addicts don't change until they hit bottom. And I've seen that before, and that's true in many cases. But here it's even worse because when you have someone who is addicted to entitlement, when you have someone who is addicted to abuse, they don't hit bottom. They actually do very well. Thank you very much. Everybody else hits bottom. That's why the rate of recidivism among abusers is so extraordinarily high, because they're not the ones who are doing the primary suffering. It's like if the people who ran BP had to actually suffer the consequences of their actions, I believe that their actions would be significantly different, because part of the problem with this whole culture is that it's based on privatizing profits, and the economy especially, privatizing profits and externalizing costs. And there is no accountability to those in power. I want to say one thing and then go to a different direction and then sort of wrap up and let y'all go wherever you want with this. But when I used to do the culture make-believe talks, there were a couple of riddles that I told that aren't very funny that get right to this point of accountability for those in power, because there's no accountability. I want to back up for a second and say that every culture has had sociopaths. They just exist. And what good cultures do is disallow them from, they don't reward their behavior. We talk about the Lakota having, you know, wonderful relationships with the bison and spiritual relationships and all that. And all that's true. But in addition, if somebody killed bison out of season, everybody else would, the other people in the community would burn their teepee, destroy their weapons, reduce them to beggary. That you are not, it's like Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons has always really pissed me off, because it's a lie. That it's not true that if you have a commons and then one person puts more sheep on, another person puts more sheep on, it destroys the commons. It's absolutely not true. What happens in a functioning community is if one person puts too many sheep on, the other people go talk to him and say, hey, don't put too many sheep on. This is our common land. And if he continues to do it, they burn his house down. They stop him somehow or another. It doesn't matter how. And back to the thing I was going to say about culture make-believe is that has to do with this, is a couple of riddles I would tell are, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. And the other one is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, who was sentenced to hang in absentia, and the United States won't extradite him. And part of the problem is that there is no accountability, and of course there's no accountability because those in power make the rules.
Derek, it sounds like we're talking about the difference between pathological human beings and pathological structures, and that at this point we have a pathological structure. People who study technology would refer to the path dependence of a certain technology. So we have these massive technological systems that have a great deal of inertia at this point, and it's very difficult to reverse that inertia. It's difficult to stand outside of it and so forth. I've always thought that maybe the reason to try at least to eliminate hierarchical structures is to try to eliminate those platforms from which sociopaths can sort of spread their pathology. You know, like if you can, it's not exactly a positive way of looking at it, but if you can try to reduce the impact of the sociopaths in your society, then maybe you've achieved something. But as you pointed out, we sort of do the opposite. We give them the ultimate in platforms for projecting their pathology. And I want to turn to tactics for opposing that kind of culture. Because initially we were going to get into the discussion of violence as an option, and I wonder, as you've said many times, Derek, that the power is not something, the powerful people and structures are not simply going to concede their power and say, yeah, okay, you're right, we're destroying the planet, I'm sorry, and then they'll step aside. So it suggests in that analysis that some kind of violence would be necessary. Is that a something you would agree with due to the pathology of the system?
I think that a question I ask a lot is if salmon could take on human manifestation, what would they do? Or if oceans at this point could, if the Gulf of Mexico could take on human manifestation, what would it do? I think if Delta Smelt could take on human manifestation, the pumps on the Sacramento River wouldn't last 24 hours. And if space aliens came down and they were systematically changing the climate of the planet, making it so the planet will be uninhabitable, including for a huge portion of humans, I think we would do whatever is necessary to stop that. And that would certainly, that could certainly include violence against humans. I don't think that, and what I would really, honestly, what I believe that we need to do is to, well, the first thing we need to do is to, as so many indigenous people have said to me, to decolonize our hearts and minds, to do exactly what Chris is so brilliantly articulating about, to see what's going on and to no longer be infants and to start making adult choices. And another thing I think is really crucial is to make our identification with the land itself and with the victims of oppression. And the victims of oppression can certainly be humans, the indigenous people being driven off their land, the subsistence farmers who are being murdered by Monsanto. And and I want to say one more thing about this before we move on, which is one of the things I tried to do in Endgame is to try to remove the notion of any sort of dogmatic pacifism from a moral high ground, because it's really uncomfortable in this culture especially to talk about. The fourth premise of Endgame is that this culture is based on a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence by those higher on the hierarchy, those lower, is usually invisible. And when it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy, those higher, is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. There are 60,000 people die every day, human beings. I mean, forgetting non-humans for a minute, even though they're being wiped out everywhere. There are 60,000 human beings die every day from the effects of pollution. And somehow, and I'm not saying you did this at all. You're being great. This is a wonderful conversation. I'm having a wonderful, wonderful time. But I'm saying that it happens. I get put on the defensive for saying we should fight back sometimes. But people don't mention that there are – the Chinese government just announced that 325,000 people are going to be forcibly removed within the next 2 years from their land in order to make way for another dam. Somehow they tend to forget that, you know, and they tend to forget – that there used to be salmon so thick that you couldn't, that Indians, one of the things they would do for fun is they would throw a little pebble into the water and they would see how long it would take before it would fall off salmon's back because they were so thick until it hit the bottom of the stream. And it might take 5 minutes. And this culture is unraveling everything. And yet somehow I then end up the violence guy. And once again, I'm not saying either of you are doing that. And no, I'm not defensive, damn it. I'm just saying that it's a really odd that goes to the whole, for me at least, goes to the whole pathology of the system itself, that talking about resistance ends up being a big scary topic as opposed to a deadly serious topic that we should all be discussing as honestly and forthrightly and as urgently as we can.
I was hoping that we could speak about violent tactics with some specificity. I didn't mean to put you on the defensive.
I'm not. I was kidding.
The context for some of this is that about a week ago there was the G20 summit in Toronto, and as we've seen at every summit for the past decade, at least since Seattle, it's the usual heavy-handedness of the police. They had 20,000 police in Toronto to protect the convention center. We've now heard charges of, we know that they did mass arrests. They beat up journalists. They snatched people off the street in unmarked vans. You know, there were threats of sexual violence against women in the detention center. All of these things have brought to light. And yet the media, of course, focused on the Black Bloc anarchists who, or at least we presume that they were all Black Bloc and not undercover police, who smashed some windows along the Yonge Street and parts of the financial district. So we go through this continual cycle on the left of, renewing an examination of what kind of violence is appropriate, is it appropriate, and so forth. Sure, go ahead, Chris.
Can I say one thing and then turn it over to Chris? Which is, I suspect an area where Chris and I will strongly agree is that if someone is going to consider fighting back, I think it absolutely needs to not be out of a sense of machismo. And it needs to not be out of a sense of generalized anger, but instead has to be part of a well-thought-out strategic campaign which includes, in which, insofar as possible, people... A friend of mine, environmentalist, says that one of the reasons that he does the work he does to protect land is because he wants to make sure as some things become increasingly chaotic that some doors remain open. I think the same thing is true philosophically in that one of the reasons I talk a lot about sexual violence against women, I talk about this in terms of resistance a lot because as a patriarchal society collapses, one of the things that happens oftentimes is women bear the brunt of that. And so what we need to do is we need to have a zero tolerance policy for sexual violence against women. And we need to maintain that. And that needs to be crucial going in because as whatever chaos ensues, and the same thing is true for other victims of white oppression, because as things become increasingly chaotic, things become uncontrollable, which means that we have to set up these ground rules beforehand no matter what we do. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, I totally agree with Derek that these systems of oppression, which aren't new, I mean, they go all the way back to the, before the conquistadors. I suppose you could even argue that this was the battle between the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons, the history of the human race is sort of the perpetuation of those groups that have the greater capacity to kill, to commit genocide, and not just genocide against human beings, but against the planet itself. I mean, look at the disintegration of the Inca Empire when the Spaniards came in. The Incas had created a huge communal empire where there was no poverty, tremendous respects for natural resources like guano, which they used for fertilizer. The Europeans came and in a few years took it all. And of course these civilizations that did not have that component of turning everything into a commodity, were killed. We've reached a different end game is probably the proper term because, these rapacious, systems of exploitation and violence could constantly migrate, and now there is nowhere to migrate. The last sort of section of the earth that was open for plundering North America is now is reaching its exhaustion, its point of exhaustion, that the environment can no longer, that this is a global phenomena rather than a regional phenomena. But the problem of, these psychopathic, forms of violence that are embraced by empire are, you know, there's just a long history of the gentle, the sensitive, and those who recognize the sacred and honor the sacred being destroyed by these entities. So Derek is very right. I mean, we're very naive to ignore the awful violence that is visited both internally and externally. I just finished writing a story for The Nation magazine on Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest as well as the most dangerous city in the country. And there's no supermarket in Camden. I mean, you have the physical violence, but you have the violence done, you know, all the wastewater is treated in the middle of the city for all the rich suburbs around Camden. And then, of course, as a foreign correspondent, as a war correspondent, I was often on the receiving end of American power. So I think Derek's right. There is a, we don't look. We don't want to see the massive amounts of violence that are used by the power elite to sustain the empire. Iraq is a good example. Over a million Iraqis have now died in this war, and we never hear about them at all. It's just one more heart-wrenching story about some wounded soldier, and I don't want to take away any of you know, my sympathy for him and his family, but the voices of the real victims never get heard.
Chris, I wonder if you could speak, based on your experience as a war correspondent, I wonder if you could speak to what the sort of typical cycles of violence or what tends to happen as societies break down. I you know, assuming that America is in this position of a kind of gradual collapse,
I watched the breakdown, for instance, of Yugoslavia. I was the Balkan bureau chief there for the New York Times. And there are many, many similarities between the breakdown of Yugoslavia and the breakdown of the United States. The fragmentation of the country along ethnic lines, the fact that the war in the former Yugoslavia was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds, but was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. They couldn't pay their debts. Nobody would renegotiate their loans. Finally, 25,000% inflation, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not, in the end, a pacifist. And I do believe that people, when they face their own, the possibility of their own annihilation, have a right to defend themselves. I was in Sarajevo during the war when we were being hit with 2,000 Serb shells a day, constant sniper fire, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day, and I more than understood why a resident of that city would pick up a weapon to defend their family, their neighborhood, their city. And we knew there was no doubt about what would happen if the Serbs broke through. We were actually defended by trenches around the city. Our fate would be the same fate as those in the Drina Valley or in Vukovar. So about a third of the city would have been slaughtered, at least, and the rest would have been driven into refugee and displacement camps. And of course, women would be herded into hotels for rape camps, and we had plenty of precedent for that. So I think that Derek is grappling with a very unpleasant and difficult truth, that there does come a point. And, you know, what is our limit? I mean, how far do we let them go? We certainly know where they're going. I guess, you know, my only caution is that from my experience, the employment of violence is always tragic. The people who elevated themselves within Sarajevo during the siege tended to come from the criminal class. They were people who had a penchant for violence and an access for weapons, and they became wealthy as well. Once you cross that line, once you employ violence, the kinds of people who do it successfully oftentimes mirror the pathological characters who began the war or began the violence in the first place. And that's my fear. But I'm not, in the end, against resistance. I do think that it is probably something we're going to have to think about. But But for me, it's always, the consequences are always tragic, even in sort of a just and understandable cause, as I think if you were a Muslim in Sarajevo, it was.
Perhaps a final question for both of you. To what do you attribute the relative lack of militancy on the left in America at this current date? No?
I was going to let Derek, but I'll do it too. You want me to go first?
It doesn't matter. Either way. I was just thinking. So either way. Which would you prefer?
I'll give you my thoughts on that. Well, there is no left. We destroyed our left. I think it goes back to World War I. That was the purpose of the Sedition Act, the Espionage Act, and mass propaganda. The day the war ended, hatred turned from the German Hun to the Bolshevik, we have been in a state of perpetual war ever since, not only in terms of furthering the perpetual war economy, but the mentality of perpetual war. And so we used anti-communism as the same way we now use the specter of Islamic terrorism to root out anybody with a moral conscience or anybody who has the capacity to, as Adorno said, the moral capacity to stand up and say no, which is the definition of moral autonomy. And so our left, what we call our left, what we call our liberal class, our courtiers, they serve an important function in that they give a kind of moral veneer to the crimes of the power elite. You saw it in Vietnam. You see it in the Iraq War, where all of the quote-unquote, liberal hawks, reluctant hawks, whatever you want to call them, said, oh, we hate war. War is horrible, but there's no choice. The Saddam kills his own people. We have to liberate the women in Afghanistan. And so they serve the function of cloaking the kind of naked violence and aggression that is used by an imperial power, endowing it with a kind of virtue it doesn't have. And they also serve a very important function in that they discredit those people who speak with any kind of moral probity and seriousness. And that's why the quote-unquote liberal class in this country, their real enemy is Noam Chomsky, because Chomsky exposes the complicity of the liberal class within the power elite. And in return, the liberal class is given positions of comfort. I would argue that most prominent liberals in this country economically live very well. I've taught at Princeton. A Princeton professor makes $180,000 a year within the church, within labor unions, what's left of them, within the press. These people were, in return for collaboration, allowed into to make middle class and even upper middle class livings. The problem was that as American democracy withered and died, and I think, you can take 1994 with the passage of NAFTA as a very good example of that, when we certainly betrayed the working class in this country. The liberal class lacked either the foresight or the courage to defy this creation of neo-feudalism or an oligarchic system. And now we are seeing in the right-wing backlash this legitimate rage that is being expressed by the dispossessed, a hatred and an understandable hatred for the liberal class. What's frightening is that as they attack the liberal class, they also attack the tepid efforts on the part of the college-educated elite to mitigate the forces of violence and sadism within American culture, which of course runs very, very deep since white settlers arrived on the shores of this country. You saw that right after the passage of the healthcare debate, when Tea Party activists on the Mall in Washington shouted racial slurs at John Lewis and sexual slurs against Barney Frank. And I think that we are going to see with this this rise of resistance, not only a kind of discrediting of the liberal class, but those values within the liberal class that I think Derek and I support, especially, of course, violence against the underclass, violence against people of color, violence against women. And I really think much of our current dilemma arises from the fact that we allowed those people who had the capacity for real resistance and to hold fast to moral imperatives. I mean, going all the way back to the Wobblies or whoever you want to pick out, to be destroyed. And the liberal class was in many ways the instrument that was used by the power elite to disarm us. And that's why within the United States there is no effective progressive resistance. I'd be interested to see what Derek thought of that, but that's my analysis.
Oh, I love what you had to say. It's I think it's great. And well, it's terrible, obviously, but it's great analysis. Yeah. And I want to add a couple things. And one of them is that, when I've talked about, you know, sort of capital F fighting back, one of the things I've found is that the audience response can be very predictable. And that is a lot of times sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists, a lot of sort of big green environmentalists will freak out and, you know, put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield. And, then a lot of, there are other groups, family farmers, victims of domestic violence, a lot of day-to-day frontline environmental activists, a lot of people of color, especially American Indians, prisoners, gang members. A lot of times they'll look at me like, come on, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro. And the point of this is that for many of those latter groups, they don't have the luxury of violence being something that's capital B violence. It's simply a part of life that you deal with. Doesn't mean you participate. Doesn't mean you don't. But it means it's not some, they don't reify it, you know, it's not something out there. They don't make it into this spiritual problem to be puzzled through. And so part of that is that I think one of the reasons we don't have a lot of resistance is that we have a lot of luxury. And there's a great line by the last poets, don't talk to me of revolution until you're ready to eat rats to survive. And there are people who are already eating rats to survive, and they're the ones who are always end up being put on the front lines, which is another thing that's very, very important, is that we can't yet again put the poor people, put the indigenous people on the front lines. Some of us who are more privileged have to have the courage to stand up and say, look, we're not living in a democracy, and we need to talk about what that means and what that means for resistance. I was on a panel. It was pretty cool. I was on a panel with Vanda Nashiva and Kathy Pedler and this nun whose name I can't remember who does great anti-war work. Everybody in the audience knew we don't live in a democracy. We on the panel knew we didn't live in democracy. But every one of us was up there speaking as though we live in a democracy. And I turned to the nun, who once, like I said, does great anti-war work, and I said, look, if you really understood, if you really internalized the understanding of what it means to not live in a democracy, how would that change your attempts to stop U.S. imperialism? And she looked back at me and said, I have no idea. And I think that this conversation is just the barest beginnings of attempting to form that culture of resistance, which, by the way, only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. You know, 98% of the IRA support. That's something else that a lot of people don't understand, is that, you know, Maud Gunn is one of my heroes, and she was an actress and singer, and she also did prisoner support work. She went to prison herself, went on a hunger strike. Her son was Sean McBride, who, chief of staff of the IRA, later started Amnesty International, won the Nobel Prize, and, you know, it's we need it all. You know, we need Frederick Douglass, we need John Brown. And so one of the things we need to do, I think, is to have conversations, and thank you too, Michael. We need to have conversations exactly like this one in every town hall, we have to have them everywhere to figure out. And I'm sorry that we have to go, because I've really enjoyed this conversation. I would love to continue it, because I feel like we spent about 35 or 40 minutes talking about the problem, and then the last 5 or 10 minutes, we've started to talk about you know, even sort of tiny glimmers of looking, you know, peeking out the window at what might be solutions. And I would love to continue this, because I think that conversations like this are absolutely desperately important in order to lay the groundwork for. Oh, I want to tell one quick story. I know we got to go. I was watching Battle of Algiers with a friend years ago, and at one point I just said to my friend, so who would I be in this movie? You know, and I was just asking for strokes. I wanted my friend to say, oh, you're one of the brave ones or something. And instead my friend said, oh, you'd be dead. I was like, thank you very much. And my friend said, no, you've been dead for 30 years and your books are on the bookshelves of the people who are fighting for, who are doing the resisting. And my friend's point was that, that this work is necessary too in order to help form the resistance. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate your words. I didn't want to keep you longer than you had agreed to. But I certainly do appreciate your thoughts. You know, what strikes me is that, you know, we're sort of talking about the potential for an insurgency in America and elsewhere, of course. And usually an insurgency involves some sense of territoriality, you know, people defending their home. But with industrial capitalist living, it's almost as if we don't feel at home enough to defend it. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the problems, and it also creates some opportunities for us as members of resistance, because one of the difficulties in any resistance movement is attempting to hold territory, which is almost impossible to do, which is extremely difficult to do against the full power of the state, because they're so mobile, communication is so fast. But if you're not attempting to hold ground, but instead attempting to destroy the ability of the rich to steal from the poor and their ability to project power, I think that gives, in terms of tactics, that will give any sort of future insurgency some advantages if they're wise about this. I want to be very sensitive to, I know I have to go in a few moments. I know Chris said he had to leave at 5:00, so I want to be very sensitive to this. And also, before we go, though, I do want to say that I know that all three of us are very busy, but I would absolutely love to do this again. And also, Chris, I just also want to put out, I know we're all extremely busy. I got books lined up for years, but if we ever had a chance to work together, I'd love to do that.
Oh, yeah. I don't disagree with anything Derek said, even to the point where we may be entering an age where, resistance becomes legitimate, just having been around so much violence, even I think violence that certainly conforms to just war theory and is so understandable. I've just found that it becomes such a destructive force, even when it's employed for a good cause, that it frightens me. However, I share Derek's feelings about pacifism. I think, you know, much of those people on the left who embrace pacifism do so, for reasons that have more to do with self-righteousness and self-exaltation than actual, morality, frankly. You know, again, going back to Sarajevo, I think the tragedy for me is that those under the siege in Sarajevo finally had no choice, and I accept Derek's premise that we may have no choice.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you, Chris Hedges and Derek Jensen. I greatly appreciate your time. This conversation is part of a film that I'm working on called The Crisis Is Capitalism, and updates for that film and a recording of this conversation will be available at capitalismisthecrisis.net as soon as we edit this